Welcome to Murder at Land Between the Lakes. I am your host, Amelia Courtney, along with Lainey Sullivan. This is Season 3, Unsolved.
Hi, listeners. Welcome back to Murder at Land Between the Lakes. I'm Lainey Sullivan, and I'm here with Amelia Courtney. And to start off, as promised, we wanted to give you guys an update on Carla and Vicky's case.
Yes, so you probably remember back a long time ago, actually, we featured a book cover that Carla had written on when she was in seventh grade. You know, all her little doodles had all of her friends' names on it, and it said, Carla loves so-and-so, Vicky loves Randall, and it had all the names on the cover. Well, moving fast-forwarding to over the last few months, we received a tip from a former classmate of Carla's, and it was the beginning of the eighth grade, and she started talking about a book cover, and I'm like, oh, we've seen the book cover. She was like, well, you haven't seen this one. And so I thought, wow, okay. And she said she could remember plain as day what was on this book cover, and she knew that Carla had had a serious older boyfriend, and she said it was kind of a secret, you know, she didn't talk about it a lot, but on this book cover had Carla and this guy's name, and so the whole book cover was filled with this. And so she, once she heard the podcast, she had just heard it because she listened to our episode about one of the other episodes we covered. Mm-hmm. And when she realized that this story was about Carla and Vicky, the whole podcast, she, you know, thought, oh my gosh, I need to call someone. So she called me and told me exactly what was on this book cover. And I think we have to leave that to the authorities to tell. I don't know if we should reveal that.
No, but it's definitely an actively being investigated case. And it just goes to show that, like, any type of information that may seem, like, so insignificant or small, just even doodling on a book cover, might be exactly what's needed to be the final piece of the puzzle in order to solve both of these murders.
Right, and just like that, she called another classmate that called me and told me the same thing, that she knew Carla had an older boyfriend, that she wasn't coming to school that much. She would stay, she wouldn't come to school when he had days off work. So she would, that's why she was missing a lot of school, apparently.
Hmm.
So, yeah, another classmate called another classmate that didn't know about the podcast, and, you know, this case has weighed heavy on them their whole lives, so.
Well, that's great information to know, and to know that the authorities are looking into every bit and piece of new information that's coming up. So if anybody has any more information out there, please don't hesitate to share. But this episode, we're going to go back to Leanne Green. And I know Amelia had an opportunity to talk to the prom date of Leanne Green, who was going to be going to the prom with her that coming weekend.
Right. So his name is Blaine Snyder, and he was very nice to talk to and told me that he didn't actually even know Leanne that long. He was a couple years older and had gone to a different school than Leanne, like a neighboring school. Mm-hmm. And they had been together about 6 weeks, talking on and off, and he agreed to go to prom with her because, oh, not just because, I mean, mm-hmm. he liked her, but his best friend and her best friend were dating, and today they're actually married. So Mike and Angela were their names, and so they were all going to prom together. And as we've seen in other reports, it seemed like Lawson and Leanne were going with their dates together, but that wasn't the case. So Leanne was not going in the Monte Carlo to prom. It's not a big piece of it, but mm-hmm. it was just something that I've seen in other podcasts and other newspapers. Anyway, so the four of them were planning on going to prom, and they were talking on the phone pretty regularly. Like Blaine even says, like that night that she went missing, when her shift ended at the Holiday Inn, she called him and said, I'll call you when I get home. Lawson's here to pick me up. So they hung up, and she left. And then it was a short time later, Blaine received a phone call from Lawson. And Lawson said, you know, did you pick her up? Did you pick Leanne up? Is Leanne with you? And he said, no, you know, we just got the phone. She said she was going with you. And Lawson just said, I gotta go. And Blaine said, no, man, what's going on? You know, what's going on? He said, I gotta go. So it goes back to us talking about how immediate they knew something was wrong quickly.
Mm-hmm. And they were able to act on it quickly.
Right.
So that leads us into a big chunk of our episode today. Again, I just want to remind you guys that we're talking about Leanne Green, whose official name is Martha Leanne Green. She was born on February 27th, 1970. She went missing on April 15th, 1987. She was 17 years old, and she was in White Bluff, Tennessee, in Dixon County, Tennessee. Amelia had the great opportunity to interview one of the lead investigators at the time who has been involved with the case from minute one. His name is Mike Breedlove, and we're excited to share all of this information with you today.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a couple of things in there that weren't quite accurate from our first episode, so it's nice to hear exactly coming from the expert, mm-hmm. right? And not like what we read or what we've seen prior to this. The one big piece I just want to go ahead and say before you hear the interview is incorrect, because Lainey and I were very concerned about this, was like, how did Lawson not know that there wasn't any gas in the car? Well, it turns out that gas gauge was broken. And so there was no way of knowing how much gas was in that car. And it's unclear whether or not he did know or didn't know. But according to Mr. Breedlove, he did know that the gas gauge was broken. Mm-hmm. So
he just didn't know how much gas was in the car, most likely.
Yeah.
You know?
There's no way to know when it's broken. So, okay. So we'll let
you listen to this interview, and then we'll come back and chat with you a little bit post-interview.
Hi, listeners. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Today, I have the privilege of talking to Mike Breedlove. Mike is currently a retired sheriff and special agent with the TBI. Today, his role is a part-time contractor for cold cases. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk to us about the disappearance of Leanne Green.
Well, thank you, Amelia. It's I'm honored to be on to talk to you about this true mystery of case.
Thank you. So let's start with talking about what your role was at the time of her disappearance.
Okay, well, just a little bit of a background. I got into law enforcement in 1980, which was 7 years before Leanne's disappearance. I started out as a Nashville police officer, assigned to patrol, and I served with Nashville for 4 years before being accepted into the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. And the TBI has the same requirements as FBI or other state and federal agencies, where you have to have a minimum of a college degree, 4-year degree to get in. I was lucky enough to be interviewed and accepted, and then that started my journey toward becoming a special agent criminal investigator. My primary duties were working, investigating homicides, also public corruption cases, drug-related cases, and any kind of criminal violation that the district attorney of the district I was assigned to requested that I look into. And I was assigned to Cheatham in Dixon County starting in 1985, and was a field agent there for 17 years, primarily working on homicides during mm-hmm. that time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at that time, you were working homicide, and when Leanne disappeared in 1987.
Yes. Okay. Also, our job as TBI agents, we work together hand in hand with local agencies, local sheriff's offices, and police departments. So part of my objective was to build professional relationships with the departments and assist them in any case that was either too large for their mm-hmm. Ability to handle. We're also set up to work long-term investigations and primarily to assist any agency, whether it's a missing person or homicide case or public corruption. We would go in and assist them. And in a lot of cases, we would be actually in charge of the investigation.
Okay, so that day in April, can you tell me how you got that phone call and how Leanne's case started for you?
Yes, Leanne was abducted on April 15th, 1987, sometime around a little after 9 p.m. She got off work from a Holiday Inn that she worked at. The Holiday Inn was located on Interstate 40, about 30 miles west of Nashville. It was off the exit 172 in a little town called Dixon. And she worked there. She lived in White Bluff, Tennessee. And it's not uncommon for us to get a call about either a missing person or a possible abduction. I got the call either late that night or early in the middle of the night, following morning, about what Dixon County Sheriff's Office had and what they were working on. And I advised them that I would be en route and to help to assist them also. So law enforcement, during that incident, they got involved pretty quick, considering, I mean, when you have a missing person, a lot of missing person cases are, you know, when they're looked at in the preliminary, they may be runaways or maybe somebody that just has gone over someone else's house, not told their parents. But this case was much different. It had all the markings of a stranger abduction, and that's why law enforcement got on it pretty quick.
We've talked about this in the first episode, and we've talked about it in other cases, that, you know, most of the time, police and law enforcement tell the families, you know, they need to wait 24 hours to do exactly what you said, find out maybe they've disappeared on their own for a little while. But in this case, I found it fascinating that they knew right away something was wrong, and I love the fact that they got on it immediately. Like, I think, you know, we heard somewhere between within an hour of her disappearance, a search was started, or everybody started looking for her.
That's correct. You know, let me say this, the 24-hour wait is kind of a myth. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of is a spawn of Hollywood and all that, and there were some departments that their policy was they'd wait 24 hours. Well, each case has to be you know, be valued by its merits and the circumstances. And so, you know, when you think, first of all, it's a 17-year-old, you know, there are 17-year-olds where the priority is not as urgent as it would be if it was a 7-year-old.
Right.
This one, in the case, it was a priority because of the fact that, you know, it was she was left on the roadside by her twin brother, ran out of gas and all that. So there wasn't a planning on her part to up and run off or go with somebody or had, you know, a boyfriend who was, you know, going to leave together and all. So early on, we learned that this definitely wasn't the first hour. But now 45 minutes, I think, was the amount of time that went by before law enforcement was called. But that's normal. If not, actually, it's pretty urgent. And the reason being is before family members want to call law enforcement, they normally they'll call all their friends, call everybody else, just in case that she wasn't picked up by a friend or wasn't picked up by somebody else they knew. And I think they were dealing with that, is, you know, could have somebody that she knew picked her up, because there was no cell phones back time. There was no way that she could quickly communicate to her brother or her family, you know, that she went with somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I spoke with Blaine Snyder, her prom date, and the guy she'd been seeing in the weeks prior to that, and he said the same thing. He said that Lawson came home, called him immediately, and said, "Is Leanne with you?" And he said, "No, I just spoke with her before she left the Holiday Inn." And that's when, I guess, you know, Lawson said, "I have to go." And Blaine said, "Why, what's going on?" And Lawson said, "I have to go." So we knew at that point, you know, she wasn't with Lawson and she wasn't with her boyfriend. So I guess everybody knew at that point. So it was stranger abduction.
Yes. And the Dixon County Sheriff's Office really got on it quick. And, you know, they called other people in. I think also family members and friends came out. And, you know, you have where she was abducted from was kind of a desolate spot. It was at night. There were no street lights. It was kind of a light rain that was happening. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we had to look at it also from terms of the physical evidence standpoint. Okay, what kind of physical evidence do we have that also would tie into her abduction? And it was very limited. I want to say that there were, I think, 11 people that had been in or around the car before law enforcement's arrival. And so, you know, that there was a lot of contamination there, but mm-hmm. we still had to process the car. We still had to, you know, do all that and photograph it and hopefully find something. But also with the rain, you know, that rain tends to destroy evidence pretty quick,
right,
whether it's impressions or tire impressions. And and I think that was the case, that we really weren't able to yield any positive physical evidence that would connect her to her abductor.
Right. That was actually something I was going to ask you, was, you know, not that it's Lawson's fault at all, because he didn't have really a choice at that point but to leave and go home, but how much did it really hurt possibly finding some kind of evidence that he left the scene to go home and try to find Leanne?
Yeah. Well, in cases like that, the average person is not thinking about a crime scene, right. Not thinking about physical evidence, and you're thinking about, you know, the emotional part of it. Okay, you know, my sister is missing, and, you know, that comes later. I think if the suspect, you know, got in the car with her, or if there were signs of a struggle, or we would have had a transfer of evidence, whether it was fibers or hair, and we would have found it. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the case. It appeared that it happened so fast, she was either ordered out of the car or physically pulled from the car. And then by the time law enforcement got on the scene, there were several people also that had been around the car, in the car, and all that. And so it didn't frustrate us on that part, because it was such a preliminary early part of the case, which, you know, there was no victim, there was no body, you know. Mm-hmm. If had body in the car, yeah, that'd have been totally different, and, you know, it would have been protected more so. But in this case, we just didn't have that.
When you talk about that short time frame, can you start by telling me, I think we discussed there's about a 9-minute window. Can we kind of start from the minute Lawson left to the time he returned to his car, and you tell me how you understand the interaction went?
Sure. First, the first thing that we were interested in is, of course, how did it come about that the car ran out of gas? And it was a borrowed car. I think Lawson borrowed it from, I want to say, his cousin. It was a relative. And the relative did tell him that the gas gauge was broken, and he didn't know how much gas was in the car at any given time. And he did tell Lawson that. Lawson was aware of that. And we did confirm that the gas gauge was broken. And so he goes to Holiday Inn. Leanne was working there as a meter greeter. She would meet people as they came into the lobby and I guess help them and direct them and whatever she needed to do. And her ship ended at 9 p.m. Lawson got there a little before 9 and picked her up. I can't recall whether he went in and got her, more than likely, you know, their twin siblings. So she probably just came out and got in the car with him, and they left the Holiday Inn, got within right at about, I think, about a mile. It may have been a little bit farther than that from the Holiday Inn, and that's when the gas went empty, and so he pulled over to the right side of the road. It would have been probably right around 9:05, 9:07, somewhere around that. It was a little after 9 p.m. when he pulled over. He got out of the car. They both got out. He opened the trunk, and there was a gas can in there. And about at the same time that he was retrieving the gas can, a car pulls up behind them, and it was a family of four, the Puckets, that I think they had just gotten out of church and were making their way back home. Wednesdays in the South, there's a lot of church services at various churches, and so this would have been the case. And there would have been probably a little more traffic on the highway because of that. So anyway, they were outside the car, and he told Mr. and Mrs. Puckett that he ran out of gas, and they offered to take him to get some gas. And Leanne was also standing out there, and the conversation between Lawson and Leanne was that she was scared, and Lawson asked her to go with him, and she said that she would just stay in the car and wait. So they left. Lawson got into the Puckett's vehicle. They headed north, the same direction that they were going when Lawson was driving. And there was a gas station right at about a half a mile. And they pulled in. It was closed. So they circled around and then drove back toward the car, the disabled car. And they drove past it. They All of them looked at the car. The flashers were on. There wasn't anything unusual. There was no vehicles around it. And they went to another gas station, a Shell gas station, right at a half a mile from there. And they, the Shell station was open. It was one that was close to the Interstate 40 and close proximity to where the Holiday Inn was. They were able to, he was able to get gas, paid for it, got back in the Thugger's car, and came back to Leanne. When we began also with the investigation, I wanted to make a determination, try to see how much time had elapsed, because we also had the time built in when they saw the car as they passed by going to the second gas station. So from the Puckett's and Lawson's, it was just a matter of minutes. And so the actual week, the following week on the same night, we not only had roadblocks set up, we wanted to interview anybody whose habit was coming through there at that same time of night, whether it was people getting off work, church people. So we were doing that, but we also had everyone involved in the who were there, the Puckett's, Lawson, also an employee at the Shell station. So we reenacted, we did a reenactment, and I want to say we did no less than three times. And each time went through the whole process, checking and getting the gas and, you know, bringing it up and all that. We had the same employee that was there. So every time that we did the reenactment, it always came down to less than 9 minutes.
Minutes from the time Lawson left the car?
Yes, the time from Lawson left the car with the Puckett's to go up to the gas station, which was closed, come back, pass the car, and then go to the second gas station and then get gas and then come back. And I think there would probably been a sense of urgency as well on the Puckett's part to, because they knew Leanne was there sitting in the car. It was nasty. It was raining and kind of, I think it was around 51 degrees. So it was kind of cold, rainy night. And so they, but each time we went through the reenactment, and I was there, we were timing them and walking through the whole process. Then, you know, it just came down to less than 9 minutes. So then we had, actually, then it would have been less than that, mm-hmm. probably less than 8 or 7 minutes, in which somebody pulled up behind Leanne's car and got her out.
That's what I was actually about to ask you that. So by the time Lawson and the Puckett's passed back by the car, that would likely be the time, right? So the time frame is actually shorter than 9 minutes.
Yes. Wow. Chances are they probably passed Leanne's abductor on the way.
Oh my gosh. Can you tell me a little bit about that search, like how the search started? And then after you guys did the reenactment, but during that time, you guys, everybody was searching too. So how did the search go? Were there a lot of volunteers involved? Were there other law enforcement agencies?
By Thursday on into Friday, there were a lot of people searching. It started out disorganized. But there was no true organization yet to come, and that finally did evolve over a few days. We were, as far as investigators, we're also trying to determine, you know, who, not only who was in the area, but we had to, by Sunday night, she was abducted Wednesday. By Sunday night, it was a full-fledged media event. So once that started, and we were interviewing. By the time we'd interviewed parents, friends, families, you know, just everyone. And then there were small searches that started from there to a closer perimeter around there, barns, empty buildings, ponds, water, you know, anywhere where possibly the suspect could have taken her a short distance. And a lot of times we will find a murdered victim that's been abducted within a close proximity of where they were abducted. So that was the priority of that. We had other people. My priority at this point was not actually being involved in the walking in the field search. Mine was getting to know everybody who knew her, getting their statements, their interviews, and also having enlisting the help of not only other TBI agents, but all the investigators and everybody we could. And my job at that point was was getting a control on who needed to be interviewed, who, what leads were coming in, who was going to get those leads, and sending them out, and then what was the response of the lead. Because once the media, well, I'm probably jumping ahead of myself, but it was kind of a blur interviewing everybody and getting everybody and getting a kind of clear picture of hopefully Leanne, but also interviewing the people who were also witnesses in this case. And there were several people that also came forward, and the highway was crowded. You know, it was a bumper to bumper, but there was a lot of activity, so somebody had to see something, and that's what we were looking for.
Okay, so it wasn't like a desolate road, and you know, during this rainy night. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, any of the eyewitnesses that may have seen the car?
Yes, we had actually two very strong eyewitnesses. One was a guy by the name of Bob Churchill. I had a blank here in a minute, because Mr. Churchill owned a business within view of where the car had stopped. And Churchill, either he called in or we knocked on the business door. I can't remember. I want to say he initiated it. My memory fades, but anyway, either way, we made contact with him because he would have been a close eyewitness to where the car was. He stated he was watching a basketball game. The game went over right at 9:03 p.m. somewhere around there, and he said that's when he locked up his business, and he stepped out, locked up his business. He saw the car, the Monte Carlo with his flashers on, and as he was going to his car, he claimed that he heard a female laughing or chuckling. I think his words were chuckling.
Uh-huh.
He said he thought it was kind of odd, and he looked toward the vehicle, and it didn't alarm him. He just thought somebody was either having a good time or laughing at somebody. And so he said he got his car, and he had his headlights that, as he was turning, his headlights went toward the Monte Carlo, and he didn't see anything unusual. He just saw a female in the car. And then he left. Well, we concentrated pretty hard and heavy on Bob Churchill because that was really out of character, because she had told Lawson that she was scared, and you know, we was witnessed by the Puckets. So that was very out of character. Why would Leon be laughing or chuckling? I will say we did a very thorough background investigation on him. He cooperated completely. We did search warrants, not only his business, but his home. We did a very detailed background on him, polygraphed him. We put him through the ringer, and he understood that, but he cooperated completely. Mm-hmm. And we could not find any evidence that would have connected him with Leanne's disappearance. But the thing that the strange part about it was the fact that he maintained that he heard somebody laughing.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been someone somewhere else laughing, and it came through. I don't know. That was a mystery.
Did he say he saw another car or no?
I'm sorry?
Did he say he saw another car behind the Monte Carlo or just the Monte Carlo?
He said he just saw the Monte Carlo. He did not see any other car around it.
Okay.
When he came off. So there's that period of time that's going mm-hmm. by, that's clicking. One of our most important witnesses came forward pretty early in the investigation, and he was a shoe store manager, and he was closing up at 9 o'clock. He when he left, and where the store was within less than 2 miles from where the vehicle was, and he was driving south on Highway 46 toward Leanne's vehicle. His eyewitness statement was probably the most important of anyone's. He claims he saw a very attractive girl walking from a car that was parked behind Leanne's car, had its bright lights on. He couldn't really tell. He said what got his attention was, number one, he wondered, why is this very attractive girl out here in the rain? And he also stated that one of the other unusual things was that the car behind Leanne's was parked extremely close to the rear of Leanne's vehicle, or the car she was in. So he was able to see her walking toward the car, toward the driver's side of her car, and he went on. So I learned, you know, through the investigation that sometimes people who see things but don't remember details, recall details, sometimes it can be drawn out under hypnosis. And my opinion about hypnosis was I knew very little about it other than what I saw on comedy shows and all that, and I didn't think much to its validity.
Right.
But we were able to, I was able to find a doctor. There was someone told me, a well-known physician who was also a hypnotist through Vanderbilt University. And he had worked with law enforcement in the past, had worked with FBI and others to help draw out people's memory of an event. And so we got in touch with him. He agreed, of course, to help us, whatever he could do. And so we asked the shoe store manager if he would submit to under hypnosis, and he readily agreed. And you know, I was educated on the art of it, I guess, or the science of it. And the one thing at that time, when this man was put under, there had to be somebody in there in the room taking notes of what the witness says, and it was me. And so the doctor pretty much informed me to not listen to him, try really hard not to listen to what he was going to say, because I could go under hypnosis myself. And I kind of laughed and yeah, right, you're not going to put me under hypnosis. He goes, no, really, I just had an FBI agent that went under hypnosis, and while we're talking, he didn't write down anything he was under. And so when that process began, it was true. This guy had such an amazing voice that just would draw you in, and that I could see myself kind of struggling and going, okay, stay focused. So anyway, he put the witness under hypnosis. So he actually was able to take what he was looking at and put it in a snapshot, like a camera going, and he was able, under hypnosis, to give details of Leanne, what she was wearing, the car. It came down to two different types of cars that he thought it was. And one of the things we were hoping was that he was looking back, hopefully he could pinpoint the tag number of the car, but he wasn't able to. But he gave us a lot more information through hypnosis. And once he came out, he had no recollection of anything that he told us. You know, we videotaped it as well. So that was a tool that helped us tremendously. I had a different opinion about that. And it helped us in looking at four particular kind of vehicles. And one of the vehicles he described was at that time the model of an unmarked patrol car or police cars that were being used by law enforcement.
That's what he described.
Yes. He described it as either back then we had Ford Granadas,
mm-hmm.
or a Dodge Diplomat.
Okay. So that brings me to something else I want to talk to you about, is another suspect by the name of Robert Richards.
Yes. Robert Richards was not on our radar at all. I received a call. I don't know how many, it was months later, not even a year, I don't think. But anyway, I got a call from Shelby County Sheriff's Office, and they had a person in custody in Hardeman County, I believe, who had attempted to abduct a nurse while she was, I think she was on her way home from work. It was in the early morning hours. And the nurse was handcuffed by the guy by the name of Rob Richards, and as she was going to be placed in his car, she smelled alcohol, allegedly smelled alcohol in his breath, and told him that he wasn't a police officer, and she panicked and she ran out into some traffic to try to get somebody to help her. And so he panicked, fled the scene. He was spotted and immediately arrested. He was charged with the attempted kidnapping of this nurse. Rob was a former security guard at a hospital, and 4 months prior to Leanne's disappearance, he was working at this hospital in Shelby County, and there was a nurse by the name of Teresa Butler who was on her way home from work. She worked the second shift, evening shift. I think she got off like at 11 p.m. She never made it home. Her husband actually drove the route that she would take coming home and found her car on the side of the road, engine idling, passenger side door open, and she's gone. She has never been found. Rob Richards was suspected of that abduction because he worked in the hospital, had either made advances toward her or asked her out. There was some conversation between both that led them. And he did, while he was in custody from the attempted abduction of the nurse in Hardin County, he did admit to abducting Teresa Butler. They also showed him a picture, and it may have been a flyer, of Leanne Green, and he admitted that he had abducted Leanne Green and murdered her as well. When I got the call, I immediately went down in the direction, and so Rob Richards was cooperative, and he was also tied into, I want to say, two other unrelated rapes of women. So he was a strong suspect. He actually drove a Dodge Diplomat, unmarked white police car. When they did the search of his car, they found 11 pairs of handcuffs, two or three body bags, all the stuff that would be your worst nightmare of someone who was a predator.
Right. The body bags, that's insane.
Yeah. So Richards became our primary suspect for quite a while. He was the term police wannabe. He loved anything and everything about police, but he was also a psychopath and probably, I don't know about insane, he was incredibly intelligent, but he was he was just a true criminal, controlled offender and sexual offender. So, you know, when you're dealing with somebody like that, you want them to cooperate, stay on your side. And Rob and I kind of developed this relationship, a professional relationship, where I was dependent on him to help me find Leanne. He did go into detail about pulling up behind her. He got her out of the car, flashed a badge, showed her she was under arrest. That would make sense on how someone could leave a vehicle that quickly. You know, your average person is not going to get out of a car and go with somebody they don't know, but if it's somebody of authority, she's 17 and doesn't know why she's in trouble, but is still following, you know, she was raised to you know, follow orders and respect law enforcement and all that. And that would have been the likely scenario of how she was able to get in a stranger's car that quickly. I'm not saying that Rob Richards did it, because we were never able to prove it, because he led us in circles for the longest time. The one thing about Rob Richards was he loved to be the center of attention, and that's kind of consistent with someone who's, you know, in his frame of mind, he loved the attention, and as long as he could string us out, including me, you know, the better. He knew more about law enforcement equipment than I ever even thought of, and this is how obsessed he was. But we wanted him to continue talking with us, cooperating, and we did excavate several areas where he said he thought where he buried her. He did say that he was very highly intoxicated at the time, and so, but he said that he buried her near a wooden bridge on a creek bed, near the creek bed, and we went in the county he said that he drove to, I was able to get county maps of all the roads and all the wooden bridges, because I'm thinking, you know, great, we'll probably only have maybe, you know, 7, 8, 9 wooden bridges, and it kind of turned out to be 100 or so.
Oh,
it was a crazy amount. And each time we would go to a location, he would say, yeah, this kind of looks like the place, and it looks like, and he did bring us to a correct location, said it happened right here, and we excavated and nothing. And so, but we knew if he put her, he did admit putting her in a body bag, and so we were hoping for that at least, or her remains would be preserved somewhat, where we could find, you know, evidence on her if he did actually put her in a body bag. It got to the point where Richards was lying so much that, you know, we couldn't differentiate between the truth and his lies, and it got to where we were pretty much done with him. He was sent back Shelby County. They worked on him for quite a bit, worked with him, I mean, and trying to get him to help them find Teresa Butler. There were times that he would say that he buried both of them in the same area, and then other times not. And then there were times when he would just recant and say he just made it all up. But the thing about it is, Rob Richards, we had him in the area when Leanne was abducted. He left. He was in this police auxiliary school of some sort, and he left there on April 11th, and we have him up here in the area on April 15th. So we can definitely put him in the area. And so that's one in which it was very frustrating. We had our highs and lows.
How old was Richards at the time?
Probably in his mid to late 20s, I think. Somewhere right around there.
Okay.
He wasn't that old. He wasn't in his 30s, I don't believe. I think he was still in his 20s, mid to late 20s.
And so he was a true narcissist as well, from what I've read and understand. And also, can you tell us a little bit about what happened to him in prison?
Yes. Well, let me back up a little bit, because there was always that hope. Well, he was convicted of either one or two of the rapes, was sent to prison here in Tennessee, and was doing his time. Miss Green, Leanne's mother, actually went to the prison and sat down with him in the hopes that maybe he would finally say something about her. And it was not a media event, but there was media on it. And when she came out of the prison, she said she's more confused than ever. And so he probably messed with her head as well, told her what she wanted to hear. I don't know. And he was a true psychopath. It was probably 2 years that went by, maybe a little bit longer. I get a cold call from the agent in West Tennessee from the facility that Rob Richards was at. And she told me that, first of all, they asked if this was CIA agent Breedlove. And I thought it was a crank call. And I go, what? And they said, is this CIA agent Breedlove? And who is this? And so she told me who she was. She said, we want to let you know your guy Richards is dead. He's been murdered by another inmate, his cellmate. And the cellmate will only talk to CIA agent Breedlove. And I thought, oh my God. So let me backtrack on that. Rob was so convinced or so interested in wanting to go and work for the CIA. And he asked me at one point, do you think there was any chance that he could work for the CIA? And I, of course, lied to him and said, well, yeah, we have contacts and maybe you can work as a spy inside the prison. He knew he was going to prison. So I was willing to promise him anything to that, because it was just absurd. But, he really, I guess, believed in his mind. So during the course of that, he had convinced his cellmate that he was a CIA plant and that he was gathering information and sending it off. And he was even reenacting, making phone calls with the inmate, checking in to the CIA and all this. But on this particular given day or the day before, he was in, I guess, like a commons area where they had phones, and he called, supposedly, and he was checking into the CIA, and he had this response was, no, sir, not that, and please, sir, and I want you to know I served my country well and all this. And this is all from the statement of his soon-to-be murderer. So he said that the cellmate said that he hung up and told him that they had to go back to the cell and talk. And he convinced his cellmate that he had bungled up a top secret operation and that he had to have himself terminated. And the guy goes, what do you mean? He goes, you've got to murder me. And he goes, I'm not going to kill you. He goes, no, you don't understand. If you don't kill me, they're going to come and they're going to kill you and me because you're a part of this now. So that night, which we corroborated, all the interviews of all the other inmates that were in that area, they prayed and cried and whatever, and Rob had allegedly instructed his cellmate that he had to strangle him with some wire that they were able to find. And instruct him that he had to hold on and strangle him for at least 15 minutes, because if he left him brain dead, then the cellmate was going to be killed as well. You can't make this up. It's like truly strange.
I feel like I'm watching an episode of Criminal Minds listening to you.
Well, I show up at the facility, and there's this little guy, meek guy, who looks terrified as I walk in, and he asked me if I was there to kill him, and I said, no, I'm not going to kill you. So nobody's going to kill you. I just want you to talk to me and tell me what happened. So he did. He told me all this, and
He thinks you're CIA, right? This guy too.
Yeah. And I had to convince him that I was, you know, nobody's going to hurt him. Help us with what happened to Rob and what he did and all this. And so Rob had, and let me stop there. There was really nothing, anything going on at the time involving Rob related to Leon Green.
Okay.
That we had actively going. So it was kind of odd. And then once he said, he led us to, there was a two cassette tapes, and there was something else, but two cassette tapes, the wire that he used to murder Rob. And, but anyway, the cassette tapes were for me to listen to. And I'm, of course, at that time, I'm getting my hopes built up, but, you know, I'm like, oh gosh, what is he going to say? What is this? And I'm hoping that he would have something about Leanne. He had a lot of newspaper cutout things, reports, clippings rather, of Teresa Butler. Nothing on Leanne Green, if anything. And all of his personal belongings that he had, inmates would keep everything to get in jail. They just hang on to it and Rob had kept everything, but leading up to his death, he urinated on everything. So he knew we were going to go through it, but he, you know, his one last lap, he peed on everything.
Oh my gosh.
So, anyway, we found his cellmate gave us the tapes, and the tapes were, on one side there was a recording of Rob singing, playing the guitar. On the other side was a recording of George Jones songs, and the other cassette tape was recordings of Richard Pryor, the comedian. Nothing on there of anything relating to Teresa Butler or Leanne Green or anybody else. I don't know if it was Rob's idea that it was going to be the last laugh, but here's the most interesting part of it. We interviewed all the cellmates, but we also found out that Rob, leading up to his death, had started selling all of these different paintings that he had this one inmate who was painting for him. Rob was getting money in, as much money as he could, and so he would pay for these different paintings that he had all over his cell. He was telling everybody that he was getting ready to be paroled out, and they were all saying, you're not going anywhere. He was telling several of the inmates, no, he's getting paroled out within the week. And so he's with his artist buddy, and we interviewed him. This guy was from East Tennessee, was nowhere from around in this area. But he told the artist inmate, he said, what would you think if I told you I was going to have myself murdered? And he goes, he replies, what do you mean? He says, I'm going to have myself murdered. And he goes, you're kidding. You know, he's talking to him. He goes, no. The inmate said that he mentioned the name. He said, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in here over Leanne Green. So something was on his mind. And this guy did not know who Leanne Green was, according to his statement. But Rob was disturbed about something about Leanne Green. And so he had himself murdered that night. But he left us nothing with any kind of clue as to what he actually did. But Leanne Green was on his mind the day before his murder.
That's crazy. That really leads you to believe both ways, right? That he's not going to spend his life in prison for something he didn't do, or he is going to spend the rest of his life in prison for something he did do.
I'm leaning toward more he did do, but I don't. One thing that struck me is that there was really nothing that was going on that was pressuring,
right,
Rob relating to the Leanne Green case, in terms of, like, to my knowledge, he had no visits from any investigators. He, you know, had no correspondence with anybody. He may have had, I don't know, it may have been somebody he talked to that caused him to have himself murder. Your average person doesn't order their own murder.
No. You know? Do you know what happened to the roommate that killed him? Was he charged with murder for that?
He was already in prison for two murders. And
okay.
This was a third. Like that, you know, he was never going to get out of prison anyway.
Right.
But, he was charged with that one as well. And honestly, I don't know if he pled or if they tried him. I guess he pled because he's in there for life.
I also heard from another detective in the sheriff's office that said this case led you guys to leads all the way as far as Texas and other states around the country.
Yes, we had sightings of Leanne. Back then we did not have social media, as you know. The only way we could get information out was by news outlets and by flyers, and also there were a few different shows during that time. There was Unsolved Mysteries with I think Robert Stack at the
Robert,
time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another show that was hosted by another actor named Stacy Keach, but I cannot recall the name of that show. And but anyway, we were putting her out there in every state, and there were sightings of Leanne Green in every state in the country. So what we were doing were sending requests to different agencies, and everyone was great. They were just wonderful in assisting us to running down that lead of to determine whether or not this was Leanne. And there were a lot of it gave me full confidence that people were looking for her, because some of the people they found had some resemblances to Leanne.
Mm-hmm.
The one that had where we got the most calls, that I actually personally went to Dallas, Texas, along with another investigator, because we were getting so many leads that Leanne was down there and she was dancing in strip clubs. And let me preface this by saying I didn't go down there because it was strip clubs, but we went down there understanding that maybe she's being prostituted. Maybe she's alive and she's being, in this day and time, it would be, sex.
Trafficking.
And we didn't use the word human trafficking back then. It was just like sex slavery or whatever. But we were, we had to go down there and see if we could locate this person. And so we had the help of Dallas police. They were fantastic in assisting us. I mean, they at that point said, whatever you need. So they helped us as far as going to these different sightings clubs. And we were like one step behind. And but we were having people like truckers or business people and all that were calling in saying, this girl's dancing here, this girl's dancing. So it was like two or three clubs that we knew she was at. We were able to locate her at a residence in somewhere in Dallas. And when we knocked on the door, she came to the door. It was this girl, and I'm looking at her, and I'm going, oh, my God. That is her. We all have twins. I'm a true believer in that. This was Leanne Green's twin. And after talking with her, she was not Leanne Green, and I don't think nor would her mother even claim her as being her daughter. She was very street savvy and had a criminal record of prostitution and all, but she truly was Leanne Green's lookalike, and that gave me hope that okay, a lot of people are watching out.
Yeah,
we had one more we had a lot of mentally ill people that came out of the woodwork who either admitted to killing her or admitted to being with her so we had to really filter through that. We had to filter through the psychics that I'll say on the psychics part of it, they really took advantage. Some of them took advantage of Miss Green, and in Miss Green's defense, she was trying anything and everything that would help locate her daughter. And
right.
I honestly couldn't blame her, and she stayed on me day and night. And it was she had a love-hate relationship with me, because I wanted to keep her up to date on things, but also at the same time, there were people that we interviewed, and she found out we interviewed her, she would go back and re-interview them. And so we really had to be careful about what information we were putting out there, because a lot of people we talked to was in confidence. We were relying on their confidence or their information And so, but I can't blame Mrs. Green for that, because I can't say that I wouldn't have been doing the same thing as being a parent.
Right. Be out there pounding the pavement, same way.
Yeah, yeah. And she was just the catalyst that kept us motivated, kept us, you know, us going. And even when the lead started dwindling down, you know, we would bring it back up, and because we knew somebody, hopefully somebody out there knew something.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Understand that this could have been the perfect murder in that it was committed where there was no witnesses, mm-hmm. and only him and her, and you know, and now, you know, the main suspect, or it could have been a completely different suspect that actually did it, and he was just taking credit for it.
How long was it from the time Leanne disappeared till this case went national? I mean, given, like we talked about, there was no social media, it was all done by, you know, contact through different agencies. How long was it before it did go national?
It would have been within the first months, I guess.
Okay.
It would have been still early on in the case when we were, you know, we were wanting to get that out there. And here's the one thing, Amelia, that I had no knowledge of, is that there were so many other law enforcement agencies that were having their own missing person, stranger abduction investigation, and there was no information being put out because it was all concentrated in their area. And here I learned that, man, there's all these other different missing persons by stranger abductions, not just runaways, but that are contained. And the word just wasn't getting out. There was no, at that point, there was no Amber Alerts. There was no, we just didn't have the communication. We relied on the three channels, and pretty much that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And our ability to get the information out across state lines in terms to the public was very, very limited. And, you know, we relied more on the simple flyers at the post offices, at the grocery stores, and that's where everyone else. And I really had no idea until I talked and met with these other investigators who had similar abduction cases, and they were working day and night and just, you know, just beating their heads against the wall because they were just not getting anywhere. And then we had, and what I'm working on right now, we had all these unidentified bodies that were being dumped. And this was also during the heyday of serial murderers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were active. There were several active serial murder cases. Also ones that were picking up people at truck stops, were picking up prostitutes. And then we were having these cases in which we were finding bodies, but we had no missing persons report on that victim. We had no dental records on that particular victim because they were never were entered because they never were reported missing.
Right.
So that, I thought about the contradictory part of it, is we have all these female victims, and then we have all these people that are missing that we don't have remains, we don't have their bodies. And there was a lot going on. And thank goodness for the advent of DNA technology and how advanced we are. You see now that there is a less, if any, activity of active serial murder cases going on. Excuse me. There is one that they think it's happening where victims are being dumped in a lake, male victims. I just saw the news on that it could be an active serial murder case going. But the active serial murderers really have... I mean, there's no doubt. I know there's people out there that want to be a serial murderer. They want it, but they know that the chances of them being caught and convicted are a lot higher today. You can't. It's hard to get rid of evidence that you can't see, and that's the evidence we look for, is the evidence that's invisible, that's there on the victim.
How crazy is it to you that if it was a serial killer, how lucky for them, I guess is the right word to use, that they come up on Leanne and find out she's in that car alone? How do they know that there's not another person in that car, or it's a male and they're not looking for a male? Like, how lucky does that serial killer have to be to come up on this car that's broken down by coincidence and find a lone female there?
Exactly. It was the perfect storm of the worst case scenario, and it was having chance. It wasn't a planned abduction. It just happened. The opportunity became there. And I think Leanne, when she got out of the car, walked back to the suspect car, maybe thinking that it was lost and returning, or maybe thinking it was just somebody pulling up to help. She probably, you know, she walked up and told him that her, you know, brother's gone to get gas, he'll be right back. And the last witness that saw her alive was the shoe manager, who said she was walking back to her car, and she got in, it was getting into the driver's side. We know that the car, the driver's side door was locked. She probably locked it, but the passenger side door was unlocked, and her keys in her purse, so he more than likely got her out of the passenger side door and forced her, you know, forced her out. He could have very easily handcuffed her at that point, and then subdued, you know, got her subdued and then put her in his car. Mm-hmm. And then it was, at that point, it was a done deal. It was all over. And then the chances are it could have been a serial murderer. We had two other people that were in the area that night. And one of them was a suspected serial murderer who lived locally. And he was a suspect in the disappearance of a few girls, a few people, even more so. And there was another one who got off that exit driving a stolen car belonging to a murder victim out of Kentucky. And he went to Charlotte, Tennessee, which is 20 minutes from where she was abducted, to see his brother. So we've got him in there. He was actually arrested the following day. So he didn't cooperate at all with us, and neither did the other suspected serial murderer that we already suspected him of killing. So they both were in that area that night. Scary.
That is crazy. This is a crazy question you may not be able to answer. In the Monte Carlo, the front, the driver's seat and the passenger seat, do you happen to know if it was bucket seats or a bench seat?
I want to say it's a bench seat because her purse and keys were on the seat.
Okay.
Maybe, but my memory, I'll have to go back and look at the pictures because I've got pictures of the vehicle and all. But uh-huh. I want to recall, I thought it was a bench seat.
Yeah, I was just thinking, as you said, she got in the driver's side door, locked the door, yeah. And if he got around to the passenger side door and before she could lock that door, he could slide her across, right?
Yes. Yes. I'm almost positive it was a bench seat, but I can, you know, I'll have to go back and look.
Yeah, I knew that was like such a small detail, but my mind started working as you said that, the scenario of her getting in that driver's side door.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, and I know so many, you know, police officers and detectives, they always have these cases and certain cases that, you know, they continue to lose sleep over at night. Is this one of those cases for you?
Oh, it truly is. She's, and there's a handful of us, people with the Dixon County Sheriff's Office, they wore this case on their shoulders for the longest time as well. Captain Randy Starkey, for example, and he and I were, you know, the two that were in it from the very beginning. And you know, it was an emotional thing too over time, because you, and at that time I had small children, and by the time my daughter turned 17, and it was the day or a few days before the prom, that's when it hit me emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Of losing her, you know, and the thought of what the parents, which will never know the horror, the sadness, the trauma that they went through, and the trauma that Lawson went through. And now, you know, I think of Leanne, and I worked with her, one of her best friends. I worked with her at a university. I was there speaking and teaching, and I see Leanne as a 17-year-old. Of course, you know, now she would be, what, I guess in her 40s or possibly
50s, I believe.
So 36 years and all. So gosh, you just, you know, but we still see that person as they were, you know, and but what they could have been, the thing is that she never had the opportunity to have, you know, fall in love and be and have children and just you know, enjoy life. And that's the part, as the older we get. And one investigator told me a long time ago, I think I was just crying in my beer about it and with him, and he kind of put it in a perspective. He goes, Mike, you can do everything you possibly could in that given investigation, whichever one it was, whatever homicide, and did everything that you thought you did to find the evidence, to do everything, to interview everybody, to be as thorough as you possibly can, and you still are unable to solve it, and that's not because you didn't try. It was because some cases just come down to pure luck. Some mm-hmm. cases come down to breaking them. Maybe just that phone call, that cold call that you get years later. And I've had those cases where we open it back up because that one phone call, that one person who had information, who witnessed it, or who 30 years later they want to talk about it to get it off their chest, off their mind. And so that's where I'm, and there's those cases out there. We all have them who work in this kind of business, and that we did everything we possibly could. Even, great minds, have other people thinking different. And I had several people that would come and look at and read the whole file. Where are we at? Where are we missing? Where are we? And here's the problem with this kind of case. You start out with Leanne, the way we are, we have no victim. As far as a victim, a body that we can take from evidence, we have no true, real crime scene that we can work with in terms of this one's contaminated, and we have no viable suspect. We've got lots of suspects, but we don't have that one person that we know without beyond a reasonable doubt that he's our guy. And so those three strikes that are against you already start now. Sometimes it does come down to luck. And it may be that one day after I'm long gone and her dental records are still out there and everything else, maybe that one person digs up a body bag and finds Leanne Green. I hope she's found one day. I really do. And but it's just, and as days and years go by, people's memories change and they kind of forget. They move on. Families have to move on, of course. And then her memory becomes just that, and then it becomes a distant memory. And I think about all these. I've been working co-case homicides now for a year. Come back, and I've been reading co-case homicides, murders that happened in 1951 and 1963, and they're as real today as it were back then. And but they were never resolved, and what they had to work with. And it's those cases in which, even if we had just some forensic valued evidence, something that had blood, something that had something that we could compare with, we have a better chance of hopefully putting that suspect and the victim together. And you can't just rely on that. Sometimes it involves just knocking on a door of someone's house 30 years later.
Right.
We talk. But in this case, and I understand that the time goes on, and those are going to be those ones that no matter what we did, no matter how hard we work, and I tell you, Amelia, so many worked so hard on this case. I mean, they worked so hard. And it's very possible we've interviewed the suspect and never knew it. Mm-hmm. We interviewed so many people, and that's just a common reality in murder cases like this. Most murders that happen nationwide or anywhere, most of them, 75% of the victims had some kind of relationship with their murderer, their killer, whether it was a boyfriend or a coworker or, of course, husband, domestic relationship, but the majority of them, there's a connection between, there's some kind of emotional relationship, some kind of relationship or work relationship. It's that 25% others in which there's no connection between mm-hmm. victim and that suspect. And that suspect just happened chance, pulled up behind her car that night and got her out.
That is such an anomaly. Like you said, too, there's just really not a lot to go on. All you have to go on are the words of everybody that said they saw something. Like you said, there's no blood, there's no evidence, there's, no one knows, where she is. So it really is one of these special cases that there's just really nothing to go on.
Yeah, and that's the unfortunate part of it, because we're geared and trained to come to a conclusion of a case and solve it, and we don't do it for us, we do it for the family, and that's, we're always working for the family, and that's what, when there's a family member that has no closure for themselves to move forward, or to at least be able to pass on peacefully. Ms. Green told me prior to her death she had cancer, and she told me that she was really looking forward to meeting with Leanne again in heaven. She says she hopes. She says, you know, she says, I've forgotten about how she used to walk, and I've forgotten the inflection of her voice, how she talked. And she said, well, maybe that's God's way of helping me heal. And she said, but I'm gonna see her one day. And I said, Miss Green, if you do, I said, would you please come back? And I don't care if you haunt me, come back and give me some sign where we can find her. And she chuckled and said she would, but you know, it's just one of those things that I hope she found peace, and I hope she reunited with her. I really do.
Well, you know, I know that Mr. and Mrs. Green both have now passed, and so I think it's great that you and several other people that worked on this case continue to be a voice for Leanne.
Yeah, and it's she affected so many people in that, and just in our little community. And I think it's just, it also is, it's the taking away of innocence, and mm-hmm. that affects everyone. And so I, you know, the years go by, and I, you know, I'm hoping though that one future unborn investigator is going to be able to take this case, and you know, and also I hope somebody finds her.
We're seeing it every day. We're seeing 50-year-old cases, 60-year-old cases being solved, and some of these criminals are still alive, and they're having to pay for it. And they're, you know, while they're, you know, living out their last years of their lives, they're just now getting found. So hopefully that's going to be the case in Leanne's case as well.
I hope so. I really do. I think about her often. April 15th comes around. It's, you know, that's when it really enters the minds of a lot of people. I'm not just the only one, but she affected a lot of people that, friends and family and just everyone that, and people that didn't even know her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why. And the great part about today's technology, we have the ability to get that information out of that abducted child quickly, and everybody's looking for that type of car or that tag number. And that's the positive. The chances of stopping someone before they commit a murder is greatly increased because of Amber Alerts and the alerts we get on our phones. And that's a great thing tool for us. It's a bad thing for the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
More of a chance of catching them.
Yeah, I think a lot of these bad guys now are losing a little sleep, worried when their day's up.
I think that, I hope that's a control factor in their lives, mm-hmm. that they have access to the internet and they can see whatever they want to see on the internet, unfortunately, but as long as they don't act out on it. And that, you know, a lot of them would be acting out on it if they felt comfortable enough they knew they could get away with it. And that's the positive part, at least, is, you know, there's the positive and negative parts about social media, but the positive part is I really believe it's saved lives over the years.
Right. Well, Mike, I can't thank you enough for coming on with us today and telling us everything that you know from the case, because there are several pieces of that we didn't have quite right, so we like to have everything spot on. So I really appreciate you coming on and clarifying some things and giving us new information that we can put out there, and maybe somebody knows something.
Well, thank you, Amelia, and I really want to keep her memory alive and keep her, you know, in the thoughts of many, and it may be that one person may say, I know something, and we'd like to talk to them. And you can call me anytime as well if you have any other questions, and hopefully this will rattle some cages and bushes.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll put everyone's numbers out there. We'll put the department's number, the TBI number, our number. You'd be surprised how many calls we get as well from people that aren't comfortable talking to law enforcement. So, but we always pass the information on along to the proper authorities. So hopefully somebody, like you said, somebody knows something and somebody will make that call.
That'd be great. I would love to see that come. Thank you, Amelia.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on.
Okay.
So, Amelia, that was a wonderful interview with Mike Breedlove. He had so much information to share, and you can tell he's really been fully engaged with this case from the moment of Leanne's disappearance, knowing that they were there, probably starting within an hour of her going missing and starting from there looking to try to find her. How was it when you chatted with him? What was it that really kind of stuck out in your mind of the details that he shared?
Well, a couple of things that we didn't have right. So I think it's always great to get it, you know, straight from the source, right? Mm-hmm. Because information we were getting from newspaper articles, other podcasts, newscasts, everywhere we looked, had a few things that were different. Maybe they're not all that important, but it's always nice to straighten it out from someone who really knows the truth. Like, for instance, a big piece that stood out to me was the fact that Lawson and the Puckets, when they left to get gas, I didn't know they went to a gas station in front of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And then they turned around and came back past Leanne. Everything was normal. And they went to the gas station behind the car. And so that really shortens the time window of when Leanne could have gone missing. That mm-hmm. 9-minute window is now shortened to about 7 minutes, or even less, because by the time they turned around, went back, got the gas, paid for the gas, and got back to the car, Leanne was gone.
Yeah, it even makes it more unusual that there was an even smaller time frame, because they would have noticed if there was somebody or another car
mm-hmm.
around the car when they passed back by.
Yeah, that was probably one of the bigger parts for me that I was like, aha, that makes some sense too. Because I'm really, really bad with, like, north and south and
yeah.
east and west. So when I say in front of the car and behind the car, that works better for me.
Mm-hmm. So I know that Mike had also shared that they did pretty detailed reenactments of that night, knowing that it was raining, knowing that they were measuring the time and actually getting it down to that 7 minutes. And they did it multiple times, right?
I believe they did it 2 or 3 times, but he did say also to even create the rain, they had a fire truck come in. And I think, you know, just so they could get the idea of, like,
mm-hmm.
how the cars were moving on the road, and they had everyone there, you know, including the Puckets, including Lawson, including the gas, you know, station person who took their money. So everyone was there involved in this reenactment mm-hmm. as if it was in real time.
And they did it also, which I thought was interesting, on the day of the week, to mm-hmm. reenact not only the actual distance and all the details of the situation and the missing person, but also the exact time period, which one of the details that I thought was really interesting was, because just knowing that area, I thought of it as being very remote. But clearly, there were a lot of other cars, and that might have been more of a busy time because, as you mentioned, church had just gotten out.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a little bit more trafficked road than just one car being stuck on the side of the road. So when they were going back and forth to the gas stations, they may have passed several cars and not thought anything of it because it was a pretty trafficked road. They may have even passed the person who potentially took Leanne.
Yeah, no, without a question. That actually brings me to talk about the man, the eyewitness who was, you know, locking up from work that night. And when he left, he saw Leanne in a car close behind her. And the thing that stuck out to me about that was that the eyewitness saw Leanne walk from the car the car behind her car to the driver's side car and got in. Now, when they found the car and Leanne missing, the driver's side door was locked, but the passenger's was not. And that was my question for Mike about the Monte Carlo. Was it a bench seat or was it bucket seats, you know, captain chairs? Because if she got in, I'm just thinking in my head out loud, if she got in the front seat, the front door, driver's side,
yeah,
locked the door, and then tried to reach to the passenger side door to lock it and didn't get there before the perpetrator did. He could have grabbed her, just slid her across the seat, and mm-hmm. probably without much disruption. So,
yeah, the one thing that I feel like is really interesting about that particular story, too, is that they were able to get to that level of detail because they identified this specific witness, and then they were able to use the hypnosis technique, which I thought was really interesting. I thought that Mike's detail about it and how he was slightly skeptical, mm-hmm. but then actually seeing it go through in person was really impactful, that they were able to get to those level of details that he remembered passing the car, seeing the car pulled up behind mm-hmm. the car, being able to really identify what kind of car it was, potentially a police car at that point in time. It was the car.
An undercover police car.
And they were able to capture all that information from having him under hypnosis.
I know. That's pretty amazing. I'd love to see how that works someday. Mm-hmm. But him saying that detail about the car, I think, is what gave more validity to people believing Robert Richards mm-hmm. is, in fact, the person who abducted her. Because that was his MO. When he was raping women, and he also claims to have killed Teresa Butler, what he was doing was pulling up behind these girls and act like a police officer, mm-hmm. and then, you know, doing what he did to. That's even the reason why he's in prison, was for a rape. Mm-hmm. So, and that's how he did it. But we also know that Robert Richards wasn't, you know, also had some crazy thoughts. He thought the CIA was after him. Mm-hmm. He actually thought he was a CIA plant, and then he had his roommate kill him. That story itself is unbelievable to me, that the roommate actually went through and killed him because he thought he was a CIA agent.
I know, who would do that? It just sounds, it's like almost like unbelievable. You couldn't even make the story up.
yeah. But the one thing too that I think, I would love to see what you think on this, because Mike and I think have a little bit of a different opinion on this, because everything else seems to line up with Robert Richards, but him lying about where the body is and not being able to take them there. You know, sometimes you just wonder if these people want, you know, glory for things they actually didn't even do. Because mm-hmm. if they're in prison, maybe they want that. I don't know. They want credit for it. But when he said that he told another inmate that he wasn't going to spend the rest of his life in prison over Leanne Green, Mike thinks that's because he had Leanne Green on his mind, and he, you know, knew mm-hmm. that it was probably going to come his day that he would be caught. In my mind, I'm thinking, is he thinking, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in Leanne Green over something I didn't do?
Yeah. It really could be probably either way, but I tend to actually think, Amelia, your thought process rings true, because he didn't really have any details on Leanne Green, or he wasn't obsessed with her like he was Teresa Butler,
right.
And he wasn't really ever talking about Leanne except for when he was trying to show them where her yeah. body was, and then that one last comment that he made
mm-hmm.
the day before
yeah.
he died.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's very perplexing.
I guess something like I wonder too is, like, not just about Robert Richards, but any serial killer, how, like Mike said, of a perfect storm do you have to have that somebody that's willing, you know, that's a perpetrator, happens to come up on Leanne, and there's, I think the windows were tinted, no, she's in that car alone, right, and seizes that opportunity in that matter of 5-6 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did this person know that?
It seems so incredible that would be the case, but maybe it wasn't him. Remember, there was the other witness, Bob Churchill?
Yes. He had heard, Mike said he heard a woman laughing outside, which is a little bizarre, but, and then when he left, he locked up and left. He didn't see any other car. All he saw was, you know, Lost Millions, Monte Carlo out there. But he heard a woman laughing. So that's a little perplexing. Like, I don't know where that came from. But they, you know, they did a really, they, like you said, he ran them through the ringer and couldn't find anything. His business, his home, polygraph, they mm-hmm. put him through it. So I just don't know about that yet.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because he stood by his story, and mm-hmm. it also was raining. Like, I don't know how hard it was raining, but hearing somebody laughing in the rain, I can understand that sticking out, like, in his mind.
Right.
So maybe he did hear some kind of laughing.
Yeah.
Maybe it was somebody else. I don't know. It just seems like some things just are not clearly adding up.
Yeah, and I do believe that if anyone out there is listening, there is an odd chance that maybe you were on Highway 46 that night, and maybe you saw something that you don't realize is important. So please call in. You know, you can call in. We'll leave the numbers after this to the TBI, our number, and, you know, the Sheriff's Department there in Dixon County. So you can call if you remember anything, or if anyone's, you know, passed down information to you from generation to generation, or something that you may know about Leanne's disappearance. I know that this is a case Mr. Breedlove and everybody else that's worked on this case has, it's really weighed heavy on them all these years.
So, Amelia, you had the pleasure of attending the Mike Weatherford show last Tuesday night. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
It was a great show, actually. Mike Weatherford and his team, they're out of Paris, Tennessee. And, you know, that's right across the bridge there from where Carl and Vicki went missing in Dover, you know, Stewart County and Henry County. But it was actually a great show. Our friend Burton Staggs invited me to come on because he was talking about a really crazy story came on. He started talking about the Buford Pusser case, and then someone came on the phone. And, oh, my gosh, if you're interested in Tennessee history at all and you know anything about Walking Tall, it might be an episode you want to tune into. They were talking about the Holly Bobo case, and then we followed it up with talking about Carl and Vicki. So if you move to about an hour and 18 minutes is when we start talking about Carl and Vicki, but I highly recommend you listen to all of it. But I think we're going to try to do this more of a monthly event, discussing missing children and unsolved cases. So we're going to be back on Tuesday, March 5th. We will be discussing Leanne Green, Bethany Markowski, and continue discussion on Carla and Vicki. And the focus of this one will be Bethany Markowski. As we know, March 4th is the day she went missing, and March 4th is Tennessee Missing Children's Day, Tennessee's Missing Children Day, which was named after Bethany. Mm-hmm. So we'll release that episode on that day here at Murder at Land Between the Lakes, and then we'll go on the Mike Weatherford show on the 5th.
Wonderful. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that'll be great. And I think Johnny Carter is going to come on that as well. Like, she's on our interview, and I think she'll be on the Mike Weatherford show as well. Okay, thank you so much.
If you have any information on the disappearance of Leanne Green, or you believe you may have some information that would help, please reach out to the Dixon County Sheriff's Office at 615-789-4130. And of course, you can always call myself and Amelia and share any information we will keep confidential at Murder at Land Between the Lakes at 609-559-0214.
Thank you for listening to Murder at Land Between the Lakes. Music by Indy 44. Produced by Discrepancy Podcast. Hosted and edited by Lainey Sullivan and Amelia Courtney.